Hi, and thank you for listening to this recording. My name is Liz Figge, and I'm joined by three other members of the ISB staff, Yulia Fagan, Rihanna Weisner, and Catherine Cancro. As you're probably already aware, last November, the board published an exposure draft which proposes limited amendments to the classification and measurement requirements in IFRS 9. Since publishing that document, the staff has received some questions on the proposal, so we thought that it would be helpful to answer some of those that are the most frequently asked. We hope this recording facilitates understanding of the exposure draft and assists interested parties in providing feedback on the proposals. Of course, the views we expressed here today are our own. The proposals are set out in the exposure draft, which is available on the ISB's website and should be used as your reference document. For those submitting a comment letter, just a reminder that comments should be submitted in writing to be received by March 28th. Catherine, could you start by explaining why the ISB decided to propose limited amendments to IFRS 9?
Certainly, Liz. The ISB had three primary objectives for publishing this exposure draft. First, to consider the interaction between the classification and measurement of financial assets and the accounting for insurance contracts liabilities, which the ISB has always said that this interaction would be considered once the insurance contracts model was developed sufficiently. Also, the ISB sought to clarify a narrow range of application questions from entities who have already applied IFRS 9 early or who have been preparing to apply it. And the third objective was to reduce key differences between the classification and measurement requirements in IFRS 9 and the tentative classification and measurement model that's being considered by the U.S. Financial Accounting Standards Board. And so the ISB limited its discussions and proposals to matters consistent with these objectives.
So what are the limited amendments being proposed?
The exposure draft does not change the basic classification criteria that already exist in IFRS 9. That is, the assessments of the business model and the contractual cash flow characteristics of financial assets. The exposure draft does, however, clarify a narrow range of application questions, such as, for the business model assessment, how to consider the amount or frequency of sales in determining whether financial assets may be measured at amortized cost, or also how to assess whether particular contractual cash flows are solely principal and interest. In addition, the proposals introduce a third measurement category into IFRS 9, which is fair value through other comprehensive income. And finally, the proposals would change the ways in which IFRS 9 could be applied early. These transition changes would improve comparability among entities that apply IFRS 9 before it is required to be applied. At the same time, the transition proposals would allow more useful information to be presented about non-derivative liabilities that are measured at fair value through profit or loss, which would respond to the long-standing concerns about the volatility that occurs in profit or loss due to the changes in an issuer's own credit risk.
Let's talk in more detail about the proposed amendments and start with the assessment of an asset's contractual cash flows. Yulia, could you explain what's being proposed?
Yes, please. The exposure draft maintains the basic concept of assessing whether contractual cash flows are solely payments of principal and interest. However, to address application questions received by the ISB with respect to particular instruments, the exposure draft introduces the notion of a modified economic relationship between principal, the time value of money, and the credit risk, and provides guidance on how such modified economic relationship should be assessed.
So what is in the scope of these proposals? So in other words, when does an entity have to perform an assessment of a modified economic relationship?
The exposure draft does not change the contractual cash flow characteristics assessment for most financial assets. An entity only has to perform the assessment when the economic relationship between principal, the time value of money, and the credit risk is modified by leverage or an interest rate mismatch feature. That is where an interest rate is reset, but the frequency of the reset does not match the tenor of the interest rate. So for example, interest rate is reset every month to a 3-month rate. The reason for the rate being set in this way, for example, to achieve a particular economic outcome or because it is required by local authorities, is not relevant to the assessment. Once again, I'd like to emphasize that a financial asset that does not contain leverage or interest rate mismatch feature is not in the scope of the assessment. In other words, the proposals do not require entities to assess every plain vanilla financial asset against a benchmark and classify the asset at fair value through profit or loss if the return is different. That said, the return must still represent the consideration for the time value of money and the credit risk, consistent with the existing principle in IFRS 9.
Could you talk a little bit about how to perform that assessment?
Well, the basic idea is to compare contractual cash flows to the cash flows on a benchmark instrument. A benchmark instrument is a financial asset that is identical in all respects, including the same credit quality, except for the contractual provision under evaluation. For example, if an entity is assessing a financial asset that contains a variable interest rate that is reset every month to a 3-month rate, the benchmark instrument would be an identical instrument, except that the interest rate is reset every month to a monthly rate.
In that example, could an entity use an instrument as a benchmark where the interest rate is reset every 3 months to a 3-month rate?
No, such instrument would not be an appropriate benchmark. This is because the modifying feature under evaluation is the interest rate, not the frequency of its reset.
And what happens if there's no benchmark instrument available in the market?
If there is no actual benchmark instrument available, an entity may use a hypothetical benchmark instrument to perform the assessment. In other words, an entity would construct the benchmark cash flows by using the appropriate unmodified rate.
Once an entity has performed the assessment of an asset's contractual cash flows, how does it then decide on the classification outcome?
Well, the basic idea is that the instrument does not have to have a perfect relationship between principal, the time value of money, and the credit risk, but it can't be too far from perfect. So, if the difference between contractual cash flows and the benchmark cash flows could be more than insignificant, the financial asset is measured at fair value through profit or loss. When making the assessment, an entity considers all contractual cash flows, in other words, both contractual principal and interest, relative to the amount invested in the instrument on initial recognition, that is, the economic principal. This is because the objective of the assessment is to determine whether the return on the instrument is still appropriate despite the modified economic relationship. In practical terms, an entity may compare the effective return on the financial asset being assessed to the rate of return on the benchmark instrument. This is because the notion of the appropriate economic return is conceptually and mathematically integral to the notion of the cash flows that are solely payments of principal and interest. However, the exposure draft does not propose to mandate a particular method of how to perform the assessment.
Catherine mentioned earlier that one of the objectives of the proposals was to address application questions and concerns. Do the proposals achieve this objective with respect to the assessment of an asset's contractual cash flows?
The objective of these proposals was to address an unduly strict interpretation of some of the application guidance in IFRS 9 to ensure that financial assets with cash flows that economically represent solely payments of principal and interest are not forced into fair value through profit or loss. The proposal captures the instruments where the difference between contractual cash flows and benchmark cash flows could not be more than insignificant. Initial feedback indicates that this does address concerns about many instruments that had caused the questions. However, while developing the proposals, the ISB received feedback about interest rates in regulated environments that modify the economic relationship between principal, the time value of money, and the credit risk. It was noted that in such environments, the interest rates are established and reset in a particular way by central authority, and the interest rates may be reset in a manner that does not reflect the reset period. there may not be any similar financial instruments in the jurisdiction that are priced on a different basis. Concerns have been raised about how to determine whether the cash flows on such instruments would satisfy the contractual cash flow characteristics assessment, and whether the proposed notion of a modified economic relationship is operational and appropriate in such environments. Through the exposure process, the ISB will gather further feedback on the concerns related to interest rates in regulated environments. We certainly welcome feedback on these instruments.
In the deliberations leading to the exposure draft, the ISB considered whether bifurcation of financial assets should be introduced. Some continue to advocate this approach. Rihanna, could you talk about why the ISB decided not to reintroduce bifurcation for financial assets?
Well, as you will remember, a key objective in replacing IAS 39 was reducing complexity in reporting financial instruments, and bifurcation was a major source of complexity under IAS 39, where the requirements were basically based on a list of examples that were often inconsistent and unclear. As such, in the original consultation process on IFRS 9, the elimination of bifurcation of financial assets was supported by most interested parties. Users in particular indicated that structured financial assets should be measured at fair value through profit or loss in their entirety. Yet, in the light of the feedback we continue to receive from other interested parties, the ISB reconsidered the appropriateness of bifurcation of financial assets in the deliberations leading to the recently published exposure draft on classification and measurement. The ISB noted, though, that the closely related bifurcation approach and the assessment in IFRS 9 of an asset's contractual cash flow characteristics do not align well. Besides, the closely related bifurcation approach would have effectively resulted in hybrid assets being classified using conditions different from those that are applied to non-hybrid assets. The basis for conclusions of the exposure draft discusses these complexities in more detail and provides an example that illustrates some of the ISB's concerns.
Did the ISB consider a new approach to bifurcating financial assets?
Yes, the ISB also discussed a principal and interest bifurcation approach, under which a hybrid financial asset could be bifurcated into a host contract with cash flows that are solely payments of principal and interest, and an embedded residual feature. The host contract could then qualify for a measurement category other than fair value through profit or loss, depending on the business model in which it is held, while the embedded feature would be measured at fair value through P&L. Although this approach might in principle be more compatible with the contractual cash flow characteristics assessment in IFRS 9, it would present other complexities and challenges. And if left at a principal level without discipline around which components are eligible for bifurcation, such an approach could be open to structuring and abuse.
But couldn't this bifurcation approach be based on how the components are managed?
So, for example, requiring that components must be managed separately? That could be one way to impose discipline, but it would be inconsistent with the business model assessment under IFRS 9 that is performed at a more aggregated level. Another way to provide discipline could be to require that the embedded feature must meet the definition of a derivative. However, in this case, the classification outcome would be similar to the outcome under the current closely related requirements in IAS 39. So the ISB questioned the cost-benefit balance of introducing a new approach, especially given that a new approach would also present the risk of unintended consequences. Finally, a principal and interest bifurcation approach for financial assets could have knock-on effects for the classification of financial liabilities. That is, because different approaches to bifurcation of hybrid financial assets and financial liabilities would be difficult to apply and understand and difficult to justify conceptually. Principal and interest bifurcation on the liability side, in turn, could also require reconsideration of the overall classification model for financial liabilities. And that would be contrary to the feedback from interested parties who supported the IFRS 9 requirements for financial liabilities. From a conceptual point of view, the ISB continues to believe the classification of a financial asset as a single unit of account provides the most relevant and useful information in terms of the timing, nature, and uncertainty of future cash flows because the instrument will be settled as a whole.
So why did the ISB conclude that it was appropriate to retain bifurcation of financial liabilities while it eliminated bifurcation for financial assets?
As you will know from experience, a major concern about reporting financial liabilities under IAS 39 related to the recognition in profit or loss of the so-called own credit gains and losses on financial liabilities designated under the fair value option. Under IFRS 9, such gains and losses are recognized in other comprehensive income. Now, if bifurcation of financial liabilities were not required, that would exacerbate the problem by increasing the population on non-derivative financial liabilities reported at fair value through profit or loss. So, the ISB decided that maintaining bifurcation of financial liabilities was essential to addressing concerns about own credit. In addition, users and other interested parties have consistently told the ISB that bifurcation requirements for financial liabilities are understood and work well in practice, and that symmetry in accounting for financial assets and financial liabilities in this regard is not important.
I'd like to turn now to the proposals on the business model. Catherine, you mentioned that the exposure draft proposes the introduction of the fair value through OCI measurement category. Why did the ISB decide to propose this category?
Well, Liz, the ISB received feedback that having only two measurement categories in IFRS 9 can sometimes be too limiting, and that this doesn't allow entities to properly reflect their business model for managing some financial assets. In particular, some told the ISB that there is a distinct business model in which financial assets are managed both to collect the contractual cash flows and for sale. Under IFRS 9 today, such business models would fall into fair value through profit or loss. This is because such assets are not held to collect the contractual cash flows, which is evidenced by more than infrequent sales. The ISB concluded that such business models are sufficiently different from other business models that would fall into the residual fair value through profit or loss category under IFRS 9. Such as business models in which financial assets are actually managed on a fair value basis. The ISB believes that for the both hold and sell business models, there should be a measurement basis that provides both fair value and amortized cost information. This is because performance is affected by both the collection of contractual cash flows and the realization of fair values. Moreover, the proposed fair value through OCI category also takes into account the interaction between classification and measurement of financial assets and insurance contracts liabilities under the ISB's tentative decisions in its insurance contracts project. Those decisions in the insurance project would require changes in insurance contracts liabilities that are attributable to changes in discount rates to be reflected in OCI. The proposed fair value through OCI category thus reduces the accounting mismatch that would otherwise arise. And finally, the proposed fair value through OCI category more closely aligns the classification and measurement of financial assets under IFRS 9 with the tentative model being developed by the FASB.
Some have argued that the proposed fair value through OCI category is similar to the available for sale category in IAS 39 today. Do you think that's the case?
No, the fair value through OCI category is different than AFS. The AFS category under IAS 39 is a residual category and is often a free choice. It's available for both debt and equity instruments. In contrast, classification at fair value through other comprehensive income under the proposals is based on a clear rationale and uses the same classification criteria that already exist in IFRS 9, that is, the assessments of the contractual cash flows and the business model. Consistent with the business model assessment for amortized cost, the business model for fair value for OCI is a matter of fact that is evidenced by the way assets are managed and their performance reported. It is not a residual category for assets for which the entity has not yet identified a business model. Another key difference is impairment. Impairment on AFS assets under IAS 39 was market-based, whereas impairment on assets measured at fair value through OCI would be based on the expected shortfalls in the contractual cash flows that arise from deteriorations in credit quality.
You said that the proposed fair value through OCI category is intended to capture a business model with a mixed objective of both holding assets to collect their contractual cash flows and selling. But an entity will hold some assets and sell some assets in any business model. So how is an entity supposed to distinguish between the different business models?
Well, business model is a matter of fact that is observed by how the financial assets are managed and their performance evaluated. In the both hold and sell business model, both holding and selling are integral to achieving the entity's objective in managing those financial assets. For example, in order to manage its liquidity needs, a financial institution may be managing its financial assets to both collect contractual cash flows and for sale. In contrast, in a hold-to-collect business model, the entity's objective in managing the financial assets is to collect contractual cash flows. Sales may occur, but they are incidental to the entity's objective and result from credit deterioration, or they are infrequent or insignificant. Similarly, in the residual fair value through profit or loss category, an entity may be holding some financial assets in a trading book for a considerable period of time. However, this holding is not the entity's objective. The entity's objective is to trade in order to maximize fair value gains, and holding some financial assets is only incidental to that objective.
The assets that banks are required to hold for liquidity purposes often are discussed as an example of portfolios that could be measured at fair value through OCI. Will banks' liquidity portfolios always be measured at fair value through OCI?
Not all liquidity portfolios will be measured at fair value through OCI, because there can be differences in the types of assets held and the way they are managed. Just as for any financial assets under IFRS 9, liquidity portfolios will be classified based on assessing their contractual cash flow characteristics and the business model.
And Yulia, could you comment on whether the introduction of the fair value through OCI category results in a more narrow amortized cost category?
It is not intended to. In particular, the proposals do not change the objective of the amortized cost category. Besides, IFRS 9 already requires that an entity must consider whether and how more than infrequent sales out of amortized cost category are consistent with the hold-to-collect objective. So financial assets managed with the dual objective of holding to collect contractual cash flows and selling that fall into the fair value OCI category under the proposals would not qualify for amortized cost under IFRS 9 today.
And what about the interaction of the proposed fair value through OCI measurement category and the new hedge accounting requirements? Will that interaction be considered?
Yes. At the time the exposure draft was published, the hedge accounting requirements were not yet finalized and incorporated into IFRS 9. So no consequential amendments to these requirements were proposed by the exposure draft. However, the relevant changes to the hedge accounting requirements will be made if and when the limited amendments to IFRS 9 are finalized and issued. In particular, the eligibility for hedge accounting will be extended to financial assets measured at fair value through OCI, which is consistent with the objective of providing amortized cost information on such assets in profit or loss.
Could you talk about the recycling requirements? In particular, why did the ISB prohibit recycling for equity investments designated at fair value through OCI, but propose to require recycling for debt instruments measured at fair value through OCI?
There are a couple of reasons. One has to do with why we have fair value OCI presentation for equity investments, and the other has to do with impairment. Debt instruments measured at fair value through OCI under the proposals are held within a business model in which assets are managed both to collect contractual cash flows and for sale. Therefore, two sets of information are relevant in assessing performance, amortized cost and fair value. Amortized cost information could not be provided in P&L without recycling gains and losses previously accumulated in OCI to profit or loss upon the derecognition of those financial assets. In contrast, fair values to OCI for equity investments is not a measurement category. Rather, it is an alternative for the presentation of fair value gains and losses that was introduced to capture equity investments held for non-contractual benefits, such as strategic reasons, rather than primarily for increases in the value of the investment. So presenting gains and losses on such investments in P&L would not be indicative of the performance of the entity. In addition, if recycling were permitted or required for equity investments designated at fair value through OCI, it would create a requirement to assess such investments for impairment, which had created application problems under IAS 39. That would not reduce the complexity of the financial reporting of equity investments. In contrast, debt instruments measured at fair value through OCI under the proposals are subject to the same impairment model as financial assets measured at amortized cost.
Now I'd like to talk about the clarifications to the business model assessment for amortized cost. Rihanna, could you explain why the ISB decided to clarify the hold-to-collect business model?
Sure. The ISB became aware of diversity in interpretations of the hold-to-collect business model under IFRS 9, mainly due to some of the examples included in the application guidance. In particular, the guidance in IFRS 9 requires an entity to assess whether and how more than infrequent sales out of the hold-to-collect business model are consistent with this objective. But at the same time, it provides an example of an insurer that adjusts its investment portfolio to reflect a change in expected duration, where sales in such circumstances are typically more than infrequent. In addition, the ISB received application questions on when sales are consistent with the hold-to-collect business model, and those questions related to the frequency as well as the nature of sales. The clarifications to the application guidance in IFRS 9 were therefore necessary regardless of the introduction of the fair value through OCI measurement category.
What exactly are the proposed clarifications to the hold-to-collect business model? And as part of your answer, could you also please comment on whether those clarifications result in a narrower amortized cost category?
Well, firstly, the ISB removed the apparently contradictory example from the application guidance and clarified that sales are not inconsistent with the hold-to-collect business model if they result from a credit deterioration of financial assets, so for example, they no longer meet the entity's documented investment policy, or they are either infrequent or insignificant, both individually and in aggregate. Secondly, the ISB also refined the language in the illustrative examples in line with the clarifications above. These proposed clarifications do not change the hold-to-collect principle and are not intended to result in a narrower amortized cost category. Rather, they are intended to ensure consistent interpretation and application of the hold-to-collect notion and thus may result in a narrower amortized cost category than some have interpreted it to be.
We've been asked whether the same financial asset can be classified differently by different entities, and indeed even by the same entity. Can it?
Yes. The same instrument may be classified differently by different entities if it's managed differently by those entities, or even by the same entity if the same type of instrument is held within different business models. The objective of the classification criteria is to provide useful information for assessing the amount, timing, and uncertainty of future cash flows. So this makes sense. It's also the case under IAS 39 today.
Okay. I'm going to move on to the transition proposals. Catherine, why didn't the ISB propose to amend IAS 39 to incorporate the own credit requirements?
That's a good question, Liz, because this is one of the main areas that people have asked us to address quickly. Based on the current timetable, there would be little benefit in incorporating the own credit requirements in IAS 39 rather than IFRS 9. This is because entities would be permitted to early apply just the own credit requirements before applying the rest of IFRS 9. In other words, entities can apply the own credit requirements while otherwise continuing to apply IAS 39.
And what about first-time adopters? Does the ISB intend to consider transition to IFRS 9 for first-time adopters?
Yes, the ISB acknowledges that there are some unique considerations for first-time adopters, and therefore the ISB intends to consider transition to IFRS 9 for first-time adopters in the redeliberations of the proposed limited amendments so that they can make sure that first-time adopters are given adequate lead time to apply IFRS 9 and are not disadvantaged in comparison to existing preparers. In order to encourage interested parties to provide their views, the ISB has also asked a question in the exposure draft about the transition to IFRS 9 for first-time adopters.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the overall effects of the proposals. The ISB's objective in replacing IAS 39 was to reduce complexity in the reporting for financial instruments. Some have asked whether the proposed amendments, in particular the proposed introduction of the fair value through OCI measurement category, reintroduces much of the accounting complexity that was eliminated by IFRS 9. Yulia, what do you think?
Well, we believe that the proposed amendments retain many of the benefits introduced by IFRS 9. In particular, the proposed fair value OCI category is based on the existing classification structure in IFRS 9, that is, the assessment of the business model and contractual cash flow characteristics. Besides, it utilizes the existing IFRS 9 measurement basis, that is, amortized cost and fair value. Importantly, the proposed fair value OCI category relies on the same impairment model as that applied to financial assets measured at amortized cost. The use of different impairment models in IAS 39 for assets measured at amortized cost, IFRS debt and equity, was a source of complexity and was the area most heavily criticized. We acknowledge that the introduction of the fair value for OCI measurement category will nevertheless increase complexity in reporting financial instruments. However, the ISB concluded that this increased complexity is justified by the usefulness of information provided. The ISB believes that the proposals will provide relevant and useful information about the timing, nature and uncertainty of future cash flows.
Catherine mentioned earlier that one of the objectives of the exposure draft was to take into account the interaction between the accounting for financial assets and the model for insurance contracts liabilities that is being developed by the ISB. So does the proposed introduction of the fair value through OCI measurement category eliminate accounting mismatches that would otherwise result from recognizing certain changes in insurance contracts liabilities in OCI?
Well, the short answer is it helps. The proposed introduction of the fair value OCI measurement category will not fully eliminate accounting mismatch, but it would reduce it in practice for many contracts. For example, if a financial asset is managed within the both hold and sell business model, which is often the case with assets backing insurance liabilities, and has payments of principal and interest only, it will be measured at fair value through OCI and accounting mismatch will not arise. If, however, the asset is managed under a different business model or is not a simple debt instrument, a mismatch will still arise either in OCI if the asset is measured at amortized cost or both in OCI and P&L if the asset is measured at fair value through P&L. However, in some cases, such reported mismatch will not only represent accounting mismatch, but will also reflect the underlying economic mismatch. That would be the case when the values of or cash flows from financial assets and insurance contract liabilities respond differently to changes in economic conditions.
And for the last question of the day, Catherine mentioned earlier that another objective of the limited amendments to IFRS 9 was to improve comparability internationally in the accounting for financial instruments. Do you think the proposed amendments result in converged requirements for reporting financial instruments?
Well, given the different starting points, the ISB and the FASB sought to reduce key differences in reporting financial instruments under IFRS 9 and the tentative model being developed by the FASB, rather than to completely align the two models. The FASB hasn't yet published the exposure draft, but in the joint discussions, the FASB tentatively accepted the IFRS 9 assessment of contractual cash flow characteristics, including the approach to contractually linked instruments, and tentatively decided not to bifurcate hybrid financial assets. The boards have also agreed on the common language for the objectives of the hold to collect and both hold and sell business models, and on the requirement to reclassify financial assets when and only when the business model changes. Nuanced differences in classification and measurement will remain, and the detailed application guidance may differ. However, the staff believes that the objective of closer aligning the two models has been achieved in the proposals. The FASB is expected to issue their proposals in Q1 2013 with a comment period ending in April 2013.
Thank you. That concludes this Q&A recording. As I mentioned at the beginning, the exposure draft is available on the ISB's website, as are the staff's contact details. We welcome your feedback on the proposals. Thank you for listening.